Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. I'm John Marzalek, a host for the podcast Queer Voices of the South, a LGBTQ+ studies channel podcast of the New Books Network. Today I'll be talking to my good friend and colleague, Dr. Stacy Reihetzer, about her book, The Healing Otherness Handbook: Overcome the Trauma of Identity-Based Bullying and Find Power in Your Difference. In The Healing Otherness Handbook, Stacy Reihetzer, a transgender psychotherapist and expert on trauma, otherness, and self-sabotage, shares her personal story of childhood bullying and how it inspired her to help others. You'll discover mindfulness-based cognitive behavioral therapy skills to help you gain a better understanding of how your past trauma has limited you so you can finally free yourself from fear and self-destructive beliefs. If you're ready to mend the pain of your past, find power in your difference, and live an authentic life full of confidence, this handbook will guide you step by step. Hello, Stacy. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much, John. I'm so very grateful to be here.
I'm so happy you're here. And I should tell the listeners that Stacy and I have been friends and colleagues for, wow, I don't know, maybe 15 years, maybe 20.
Something like that. It's been a long road.
Yes, it has. It's been a wonderful road. So would you begin by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So, in addition to the description that you just gave about me, I am a San Antonio, Texas native. I live in Chicago, Illinois. I am so very passionate about helping people find freedom from the messages that otherness instills, the messages that they still carry with them about how they should be, who they should be in the world. That came a lot from experiences of bullying, from mistreatment, from minimization, all of the times that they had to exist in closets and to pretend that they were something they were not, or were scolded or chastised or shamed or humiliated or violently mistreated and experienced perhaps even hate crimes and horrible, horrible things in response to themselves, whatever the selves that they bring are. And there's many, many different ways of being in the world. And my book addresses those, and I really consider it my focus in life as a counselor, as an educator, and as a person just moving through life to really work to heal the world, to try and give people an alternative message from that their oppressors have attempted to instill in them.
Beautiful, beautiful. And I should add here to our listeners that we always explain why we brought somebody onto the show. And first of all, Dr. Stacy is originally from San Antonio, Texas, which is definitely in the South. And secondly, her book is so powerful in helping people understand their otherness and finding ways to overcome it. And we just thought it was so important for our listeners to hear about it. And I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about how you came about writing this book in the first place.
Sure. Well, a lot of my story is, of course, embedded in trans identity development as a young kid. I'm 50, and it's so, you know, we can do the math. And so I was a young gender nonconforming kid in the 1970s, and this was before the term gender nonconforming was known, certainly to me, but it was just not language that was used to describe experiences. So I didn't have access to it, and I didn't even know I was different until the summer after second grade. And that day, I rode my bicycle to the school playground. It was behind our house that we lived at the moment, and of course, in the summer, the playground was open, and the kids from the neighborhood would go and play on the swing sets and monkey bars and ride our bikes around the empty hallways of the campus. And on this particular day, there were some older boys that were playing on the swings, and I rode my bicycle up them in anticipation, as you can think about what it is to be a young kid and to want to be there with the older kids and just to kind of want to be with those we think of as cool. And when I rode up my bike up, you know, there was an immediate hostility. That was the first time I was ever called a fag. They said, you know, get out of here, faggot, get out of here. You know, and they just became real. It was just really angry and aggressive. I didn't know what fag was. I didn't know what that meant, but I could read hostility and I could read, I could read violence. I knew fear in that moment. And I took off, I rode away from them, and they were picking up these big clods of Texas dirt and throwing it after me. And it was a terrifying moment, but it's etched in my memory forever. And I think the reality for me was that there were two parts of myself that really came to be that day. The first of these, of course, was just a lot of fear and a lot of negative messages about who I was in the world. And whatever faggot meant, and also though the more important part, and this is what I want to get to, is that there was something of a tree planted. There was a small bit of me that day was learned about resiliency, and that resiliency continued to be fed and to grow even as continually negative messages came my way. As more people called me faggot, as it became more violent when I got into middle school, into high school, and people spat on me and wrote AIDS fag on my locker because it was the 80s. What they were shaming me for, what they were outcasting me for, was gender nonconformity. I wasn't like other boys. It had nothing to do with sexual identity, of course. I wasn't sexually active in these young ages, but that's what I was experiencing. And then as a young transsexual woman, I started my transition when I was 19, and I was in Texas and had that whole experience of just, being called a dude in a dress and having so many really, really hostile interactions with people who sought to reduce me. And when I finally got through all of this and made the decision to become a counselor, it was with an intent that I would do something for people so that they didn't have to experience what I had experienced. And when I became an educator later on and had beautiful mentorship by my own wonderful wise woman who was supportive of me and my director of Sarita Dixon Saxon, she said, if I was Stacy, I'd write a book. And it planted a seed. And I realized that there was a story to be told, but it was a story for all of us. It was a story, my story. It was her story as an African-American woman. It was a story of people growing up in the United States and other parts of the world and being oppressed for sexual identity, for gender, for racial or cultural identity, or because of some sort of a physical feature about them that somebody else had decided was marked them as less than and worthy of shame, worthy of oppression. It was for religion and for neural makeup, people with ADHD that had been just horribly mistreated by teachers and other kids in their classrooms. There were so many experiences of otherness that as I was gathering stories, I discovered, and it just was finally the point where to to tell the story of us, and to do so with a real message of healing, and how to begin transforming all of these messages that we received along the way, all of this hurt that was embedded in our histories, and to really recognize our worth and to free ourselves from what somebody else tried to instill in us.
Yeah. And you use the term othering throughout the book. And of course, in your title, you have otherness, that describing how people treat people differently just because they're different in some ways, and all those ways you just highlighted. And how does othering affect us, especially those of us in the LGBTQ plus community?
Well, it has a really profound effect on us because, you know, in whatever ways we were othered, for whatever reasons we were cast out, whether it was by our family of origin, whether it was by our community, whether it was within our schools, whether it was by a religious institution, or maybe all of the above, and maybe even intersected with other aspects of someone's identity, for instance, for their race or their culture and their sexual identity or their religious tradition, whatever it might have been, there are a lot of different ways that people have been othered. And what happens with us is that we experience this, and it is really very much a profound social trauma. And to really get a sense of what this is as a social trauma, I invite listeners to consider just for a moment, bring to mind a time when you banged your shin, and you immediately remember. When I say remember the time when you banged your shin, you remember banging your shin. You remember how painful banging your shin was. You know what it's like to bang your shin on something, and that's real, because that pain registers in the anterior cingulate cortex. We register pain. We register physical pain immediately, and then we recall it again and again and again. And we recall it for a good reason, because if we can remember physical pain, then we can perhaps not wreck our shin bone. But recalling, you know, oh yeah, I need to protect my shins when I'm around that coffee table that hits at just the right spot or whatever it is. Now, I want next to invite listeners to bring to mind a time when you felt humiliated. And the chances are, if you can allow your mind to drift back to that, you know what humiliation feels like. And you can recall humiliation with the same intensity of wincing pain with which you recall the experience of banging your shin. And the reason is because we register social pain, the pain of exclusion, the pain that comes with humiliation, in the same place that we register physical pain. That's the same part of the brain. So, and there's a good reason, again, because if you remember what humiliation feels like, you will do absolutely everything in your life to avoid ever experiencing that again. So what starts to happen is that we start fearing people who and interactions and situations that we deem potentially threatening, potentially humiliating, potentially outcasting, for good reason, because that's what keeps us safe. And so our lives become so much about this this emphasis on safety that we start existing with fear as in our forefront. And with that in mind, we start developing rules that we begin living by. And these rules really are sort of an inner construct. A way to think of it is that we've experienced these things in the external world so frequently, these messages that, ooh, you know, you better tone it down so to keep yourself safe. You don't want to act gay in public. You better tone it down so that people don't recognize you as visibly trans, and so that you can pass as cisgender. Whatever the story is that people are doing, if you're feeling pain, don't name it, don't acknowledge it, pretend it's not there, because you don't want to show vulnerability. These are the kinds of things that we learned, either, you know, maybe somebody who was well intentioned told us these things, or we just learned them as a method of adapting to a really slanted world that had so many odds stacked against us as queer people. And we began responding to this stuff and living by and creating our own rules that I've called the rules of fear.
Why is it important as you say in your book, to explore our otherness memories and get to the, I think you call it the root of where this began?
Well, that's a really good question because, you know, when we're doing this, it's important to recognize we're talking about trauma work. And I think people sometimes want to minimize it and say, oh, it wasn't so bad. It's not trauma. It's not really trauma. I didn't go through what this other person went through, you know, and they'll compare themselves to very extreme cases, you know, to people who, you know, have been maimed or put to death for their otherness. And so we say, oh, yeah, it's not so bad. It's not so bad. You know, I got through it. I'm okay. But in fact, the truth about it is that there's a lot of stuff we carry that we've just swallowed. We've just swallowed this stuff. And so we're carrying it around. We move through life. And what happens is this stuff that we've not ever dealt with just kind of explodes and shows up in our present day lives, so that we're in a situation where, for instance, we encounter a microaggression, and suddenly we're 16 years old again, and remembering that time when XYZ happened. You know, we can be very advanced intellectually and very, very well socially developed, and be very networked, and be otherwise very successful in our lives, and still not have done the work on our emotional health. So if we can begin understanding those early memories are still present, then we create the opportunity to really begin dealing with them. As I spoke earlier about my own metaphor of the day, you know, the day that I was othered, and how there was a tree that was planted, and there were a lot of other weeds. Well, that tree is still there. That tree is in the middle of the garden, and it's gotten big, and it's kind of overgrown, but it's big and it's mighty and it's essential. But around that, there's a lot of weeds. There's a lot of junk that's there, a lot of distorted beliefs that I had about myself and that we as queer people have about ourselves. And having lived in a homophobic, heterocentric, biphobic, transphobic world that has told us that we are less than. We have taken the messages that we receive from the outside world, and now we do the heavy lifting for our haters, and we've internalized this stuff, and we use it to operate in our present day lives. And so it is essential to begin uprooting this stuff, because essentially when we start looking at these things, we're really getting to the ability to, we're really creating an opportunity, I should say, to tackle these weeds, to get rid of the weeds that are there, that are just overgrown and that are really disrupting our lives and our happiness.
Yeah, you know, and it strikes me as you're talking about this example from your own childhood about how I know you and I have both talked to clients who've told stories that are not the same, but similar stories of being treated this way as a kid. And, you know, and I know we both talked to them about how as adults you look back and you think, well, it's no big deal. They threw dirt at me and I rode my bike away. They called me names. But then if you go back and put yourself in that child role, what it was like to be a child, and you realize how traumatic it was, how as a child it might feel that they could kill you, they could hurt, you know, really hurt you. It can feel like it's this terrible trauma. And we don't realize that as adults, it seems like.
No, we don't. We don't. And that's, and then in our present life, how often we re-encounter fear. And the thing is that, again, if we recognize that the human brain, in all of its magnificence, it exists to keep the body alive. It exists to keep us surviving. And so we learned fear as a way to be able to take care of ourselves. So that fear that we learned on that day, with that first time we knew we were othered, was fed each time we were subsequently othered. And it's fear that we have also gone back to, even in moments where we weren't necessarily being othered, perhaps, but because we have been othered so many other times, we have what's called rejection sensitivity to experiences in which we will perceive rejection even when none is intended, or when or in a situation that otherwise might be neutral. We see it as, oh, they don't want me because of this. They're laughing because of me. You know, I think about how many people I've worked with that had extreme social anxiety, and they really believed that when they walked into, you know, a restaurant, that everybody's just looking at me. This belief in their hypervisibility because of whatever their whatever about them they thought was visibly queer. So, but that's what otherness does. It creates that kind of thing for us.
You become hyper-vigilant to protect yourself, I think you talk about in the book, right?
Sure, because everything becomes about this. And that's what those rules of fear do. They instill that hyper-vigilance. And one of these that's very common that I see all the time, it's you must work twice as hard. Because if everybody's staring at you, if your all eyes are on you, then in your mind, you're recognizing that everybody's expecting you to fail. And therefore, you must work twice as hard to prove yourself, to prove your worth, whether it's, and this is, this, people do this in a lot of ways. They prove this worth oftentimes in the workplace. My first boss, when I had my first real job at a call center, was a gay man, and he was working extraordinarily hard all the time. Well, why? Well, he was a Mexican American man. Growing up in San Antonio, Texas, and he was out and gay in 1990, newly promoted to a management position. So there was the very real thing that, in fact, all eyes were on him. But you can also imagine that. Even when in those moments when those eyes weren't on him, in his mind they always were. So he was always working twice as hard to prove himself. Now, this, you think to yourself, well, is there anything that's logical, that has to happen? But the truth about it is that if you're working twice as hard, there's going to come a point where you're going to burn yourself out. If you and I went and bought the same car, the same make and model car today, brand new. And you drove yours twice as hard and twice as fast as I do mine. Well, in 5 years, whose car is going to be in better shape?
That's a great metaphor. Yeah,
it's the same thing in the human body, because when people pour themselves into proving themselves in one area of their life, whether it's professional, whether it's personal, because maybe it's a relationship, because they're looking for validation, so they so desperately want love, they want queer love, they want queer validation. So they're working twice as hard for a relationship and sacrificing huge parts of their own mental well-being and things that they know they need so that they can show up for this. And the only person that's ever served is, first of all, that one, if in a relationship or we're trying to prove ourselves to somebody else, it may serve them. And what's also true is that oftentimes that will attract really, really predatory people who aren't very good for us. But in a workplace, you can think about this. Well, who benefits from somebody working twice as hard?
Oh, yeah.
The business. Yeah. The business will work. It may benefit, but not the queer person who's working twice as hard to prove themselves. So ultimately, it's a losing game because we're going to sacrifice our health. We may sacrifice relationships. We will sacrifice all kinds of things. And we don't build ourselves toward happier, more fulfilled people over this experience of working twice as hard. So working twice as hard is a false promise that will not get us what we want, but it is a very logical way of engaging the world because we've experienced things that told us we must constantly prove our worth and prove that we are not what people have said we were. So we're trying to prove that to other people, but most often we're trying to prove that to ourselves.
Yeah, and talk about how this is related to what you call the internal oppressor.
Well, the internal oppressor, you know, it's such a big part of us because, you know, you're just going along and that internal oppressor is there to tell you, this isn't good enough. This isn't really a good thing. This is not top quality. You're not doing 200% right now. It's this shaming voice that the internal oppressor uses to continually show up and to diminish us in those moments when we're weakest. And the internal oppressor loves to show up in those moments when we're hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. And anybody who's in 12-step understands the H-A-L-T, halt. You know, you don't, because those things lead to relapse. Why is that? Because if you're hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, you're emotionally very, very vulnerable. That's when the internal oppressor will attack. And the internal oppressor is that part of us that it's really, really just a series of beliefs and things that can be changed. and a part of us who can be weakened, but that part of us that shows up to try and keep us working, keep us doing more, keep us trying to prove that we are not something that the society has said we are. It's easy for us to slip into these messages that the internal oppressor has instilled.
Yeah, and you have these great stories throughout the book that give examples of these different concepts, these stories of people who've been othered and how they've been affected by their, you know, internal oppressor or all these rules. One of the things that I loved is one of the ways that you talk about fighting back against the internal oppressor is using something you call SASS. So I wonder if you could tell us about SASS.
Well, I will. And I'm going to tell you, SASS is just one of the most fundamental things that we have as queer people to use as often as we need to. And I'm going to tell you why, because actually SASS itself as a concept for me in responding to otherness comes from within our queer community. My older trans sister, she's no longer with us. Her name was Sassy St. James. She was a gender non-conforming boy during the 60s and 70s in San Antonio, Mexican-American, grew up in the projects, had a lot of things that worked already against her because of growing up in poverty, growing up in a racist culture, all kinds of things like that, and then being gender non-conforming. And beginning her transition then in the late 70s and early 80s. And yet, even in spite of the rocks that they threw in, the violence, the horrible things that she encountered again and again and again, she created a stage presence, and she named herself Sassy. Sassy held her ability to talk back to the transphobic world that she grew up in, the racist world that she grew up in, the world that wanted her to believe that she was less than, that she was not worthy. She was beautiful. She could dance. She had talent. She had humor. She had just so much of a presence, and she was unwilling to allow this world that had told her so much to define who she was. And what we also recognize now, talking about this, is that as much as she was talking back to an external world, she was also talking back undoubtedly to her internal oppressor, and proving herself to herself every time she went and she got on stage, every time she transgressed in the world that she was living by just showing up, by just being queer, by being a trans entertainer. And so it occurred to me that if Sassy could do what she did, there was something that could perhaps be bottled up and shared with people as they're reading this. And so for me, SASS is one of the tools that I provide. The others are clarity, compassion, and creativity. SASS is the fourth. And SASS is when you have made a commitment to change, when there's a voice that's told you that something can be different or better about your life, SASS is you using the audacity to do it, to move forward with that thing that you know is going to make you happier, more fulfilled, that's going to be following a dream or whatever the reality is that you're needing. And that means, of course, different things to different ones of us, and it's at different times. And the truth is that even sometimes we strike out on something and it doesn't pan out as we wished. And SASS is what we return to keep going and to recognize that doing it the first time and striking out is nonetheless just practice on doing it. You know, that's on trying it. You understand this is somebody who studied French. And the truth is that the first times you try and speak sentences, you're faltering. It doesn't sound good. That's just how it is in learning a language. And that's what, you're just trying to do this. But as you keep putting yourself out there, you grow, you become stronger at it. And as you keep learning to trust your instincts more than your internal oppressor, as you keep moving toward the light that is your freedom instead of engaging once again the darkness, the sadness, the despair that otherness has instilled, that's what allows you to move forward in life. That's what it takes to live an audacious and free life. And that's what I guide that's what I guide readers to do in the Healing Otherness Handbook.
It's interesting that you use the word audacious, because I was sitting there thinking to myself, I wonder how, and maybe you can tell us, how is audacity related to sass?
You know, it's interesting, because I think that sass and audacity, they're very much, they're really sister concepts. Because we think about audacity, and it oftentimes is done with just it's seen as negative. It's interesting because, he had the audacity to say to me XYZ, that's oftentimes the way that audacity is talked about.
Well, if I could just jump in, this may help. I remember when Pete Buttigieg was running for president, he kept saying over and over again that I have the audacity to run for president as a gay man.
That's right. See, that's a great way of saying that. I'm glad he used audacity and not sass.
he doesn't seem as sassy. Yeah, but that's a different story. Yeah,
but the audacity of that is having the radical dream and having the power within, trusting the power to move with it, to say even though I'm a gay man and I know I'm going to come up against all kinds of people who are going to try and throw things to me, trust that you are not going to throw anything at me that I haven't made even worse for myself. And so there's nothing you can tell me that suggests I can't do this now. And audacity is taking that hope, that vision, and saying, I'm going to go ahead and go for this in spite of. I'm going to go ahead and do it in spite of you not believing that I'm worthy of being here on this stage as a gay man. I'm going to move forward in spite of you not believing that I have the right to take up space as who I am as a queer person, that I can't express my queerness in a way that is absolutely authentic for me. And that's really what this is. And that's what we're talking about. So they're very similar concepts. I think with sass, it sometimes speaks to us because it allows us to be just a little bit more celebratory of what is queer, because sassy feels very queer to me. It feels very, very rooted in a right of queerness that we get to claim. And so that's how I view it. Audacity is sass in a 3-piece suit.
That's a great way to say it, Stacey. Yeah. I love that.
Thanks.
Yeah, and as the listeners can see, she has a way with words. These metaphors in the book are just wonderful. I wondered, we only have so much time, I know, because you're a busy woman these days promoting this book, but I wondered if you could tell us, just give the listener a taste of some of the different, you have these wonderful activities through the book to guide somebody in identifying and then overcoming this trauma. I don't know if you can give us just a taste of that.
Sure. You know what? I think that let's do this. Maybe a way to just kind of get into this experience is to really bring to mind a story that's within your background, and it can be something that's quite old, or it can be something that's very recent. A story of your own othering. And what that was and what that consisted of. And you know what othering looks like. So to kind of guide us there, it might be helpful for listeners, if you're able to do so, just to focus right now on the instructions and just breathe and take this in through the nose and out through the mouth. Once more into the nose and out through the mouth. And I'll guide this a third time into the nose and out through the mouth. And certainly if you're driving on the road, or if you're doing something else that requires you to maintain concentration, then please do that, and so that you can arrive safely at whatever your destination is. But alternatively, if you're not, you can close your eyes or just cast your gaze down and continue with the breath in through the nose and out through the mouth. And as you do so, just you might have to-do lists, you might have other things, distractors that show up. Just allow those to float away. If they show up, imagine them as a bird, and just allow the bird to fly away, released with the word thinking. And just continuing with your breath, and allow yourself to really land wherever your otherness story was. Wherever it's been historically for you, you know what it was to feel other for your queerness. You know what it was the first time that somebody told you what it means to be gay, or to be bisexual, to be a lesbian, to be transgender, or whatever other part of you has been most othered. So just simply notice that. And as you do, just experience that person, that story, as if you were watching it on a screen. It's easy to remember remember a story through the lens of having witnessed it while we were going through it. But instead of just doing that, I'd like to invite you to sort of separate yourself from it and imagine that you're watching that story on a screen and noticing the you who was on that day, and the people who surrounded you, people who were there, and really the background of what was going on in that made this situation as it was. Once you have a real sense of that, you have the possibility now of imagining a different future for that you. You have that you who was there then experiencing this otherness, whether that was then 30 years ago or 40 years ago or decades previously, or whether it was the you last week. You have that memory with you. But remember now that story and consider if this was something that was to have a sequel, this story there, what would the sequel be if it was to begin today? What would this new story be for you that was going to begin today? From that history, that story of otherness that was then, what's the you who needs to be here now in response to that? What needs to be different? What needs to be possible? This is an opportunity to really reflect on what can be different from those experiences, all the things that happened for that child. What can happen now to begin correcting that, whether it's something in your own, in your external world, whether it's something within your belief system and how you've really treated yourself to this point. And I invite readers and listeners to reflect on that for a moment and just to kind of allow yourself to drift with whatever is possible for you and whatever it is that you wish to be and do differently in response to that moment, that experience from the past. And that's just a bit, John, of what a listener can expect to experience in response to this, to their story of otherness, and to what they would get when they encounter the book is an opportunity to really recreate some of these parts of themselves that have shown up as a result of having been othered.
It's beautiful, and there, as you said, there are so many beautiful and powerful activities through the book that you share with readers.
Thank you.
Yeah. I know we just have a few more minutes. I just wondered if you could just, last question I have for you is, and I think it's such a positive way to end the podcast too, is you talk about the importance of community, especially for those of us in the queer community. Just wondered if you could just speak for a moment on that.
Sure. And, you know, it's community is sometimes a challenging thing for people because, you know, if some of the otherness that you've encountered has been layered on by encounters within the queer community, because what's true of us is that we recreate the same problematic power structures that exist in society. So there is racism, there is ableism, there's certainly classism. It is also oftentimes the case that the queer is very driven by gay men of a certain background, and it's that's oftentimes been what sort of defines what is thought of as queerness. So the thing I would say to that is that sometimes there's a need to search and to find your pack. And the thing I would say is the people who are going to support you are going to really be the family of choice. Mm-hmm. Are those that will really see to your well-being, that want you to exist as a creative being, that want you to really express yourself and to live your biggest you, whatever that is, your most loving self, your most your self who is really authentic, and it's you know that you're with the right people, because when you're with them, you feel unguarded. You feel like you can just really be show up in a very real way. You can show up as you need to. You can show up for in whatever way you wish to show up. It's your right to choose, and a family of choice supports your right to choose because they've chosen you and you've chosen them. So. I'm a big lover of queerness. I love being queer, and I didn't always used to. I didn't always used to have a real sense of that. And so it took me a long journey to accept myself as first, you know, first a gay person, and then a gender nonconforming person, and then a transgender person, and to ultimately really come back to this and say this is really the people amongst, you know, whom I want to be amongst. That's really what it is. And so it's really about finding one's way home and finding those spaces where you really identify your pack.
Yeah. Wish we had time to talk more about that, but I know you have another engagement coming up. So I just want to thank you so much for joining us today. Just a wonderful, wonderful talk with you.
Well, I want to thank you. It was just my pleasure, and thank you all again for listening. You can check me out and learn more about what's going on with me at my website, www.drstacee.com, drstacee.com. I bet you that's probably going to be on the link, isn't it?
It is going to be on the link, and I was going to also say that if any of our listeners are interested, and I highly encourage you to read the Healing Otherness Handbook, there's going to be a highlighted title of this book in the description included with this podcast, and you can go directly to that link and to purchase the book, or you can also go directly to the New Harbinger publisher website.
Great. Thank you so much.
Sure. And everyone, thanks for being here and listening, and join us again next time for Queer Voices of the South on the New Books Network.